These notes on the Apocrypha cover the Greek additions to the book of Esther. Our notes are taken from the Invitation to the Apocrypha by Daniel Harrington. The story of Esther is set in the Persian court at Susa in the 5th century B.C. The author knows Persian customs and is respectful of the Persian king, as long as he does not persecute the Jews. The book was composed in Hebrew, probably in the mid or late 4th century B.C. It is historical fiction, a short story or novella, like Tobit and Judith, other books in the Apocrypha. It tells how the God of Israel saved Israel from annihilation by means of Mordecai and Esther. It also explains why the Jews celebrate the Feast of Purim, meaning lots, in the middle of the month of Adar, about a month before Passover. Despite its literary merits and subtle theology, the Hebrew Book of Esther presented problems in Judaism. Not only does it not mention God, but also it is silent about circumcision, food laws, and Sabbath observance, which were major concerns for Jews in the diaspora. Moreover, Esther becomes queen by first having become a part of the royal harem and is involved in a mixed marriage with the Gentile Persian king. The Greek translation of the Book of Esther turns the implicit theology of the Hebrew version into an explicit theology by introducing mention of God into various points in the main narrative. The Greek version also contains 6 lengthy additions. In his Latin translation, Jerome gathered all the additions into an appendix and made them into what became known as chapters 11 through 16. In modern translations, the additions are put into their original order in the Greek version of the Book of Esther, and they are numbered editions A, B, C, and so forth. We continue now with an overview of the content of the Book of Esther. Edition A concerns a dream and a conspiracy. It first provides basic information about Mordecai. He was a Benjaminite exile, serving the court of the Persian king Artaxerxes in Susa. Mordecai's dream places the story of Esther in a cosmic and even apocalyptic framework. At the sound of thunder and earthquakes, 2 dragons emerge, and all the nations prepare to wage war against the righteous nation. In their plight, the righteous people cry out to God. The answer to their prayer takes the form of a tiny spring that becomes a great river. Its appearance is accompanied by abundant light and a great reversal. The lowly were exalted and devoured those held in honor. The interpretation given the dream in edition F at the end of the book equates the 2 dragons with Mordecai and Haman, and the spring becoming a river is equated with Esther. Since the dream reveals what God had determined to do, it provides a framework for interpreting the story that follows. The second part explains how Mordecai became influential at the royal court and why Haman hated him. There are, however, tensions between this account and what appears in the main text. On overhearing the conspiracy against the king between 2 eunuchs named Gabatha and Thara, Mordecai reports the plot to the king, who interrogates the plotters and has them executed. In chapter 2, it is Esther rather than Mordecai who reports this to the king. The king has a written record made of Mordecai's benefaction and orders him to serve in his court and rewards him. Mordecai's success and rise to prominence are balanced by the introduction of Haman, who is to be his rival and the enemy of Israel. Edition A describes Haman's hostility to his support of the eunuch's conspiracy. In chapter 3, Haman seems to be especially upset by Mordecai's refusal to bow down to him. Continuing in the Hebrew version, chapter 1, the banquet given by King Artaxerxes is interrupted when Queen Vashti refuses his command to display her beauty to all the governors. The king and his counselors decide that Vashti must be replaced, lest the other women follow her example of disobedience. The search for a new queen in chapter 2 brings Esther into the plot. Having been introduced into the king's harem, She finds favor with the king and is given the queen's diadem. Though Esther has kept secret her Jewish identity, her guardian Mordecai instructs her to fear God and keep his laws. The plot is foiled when Mordecai uncovers the conspiracy and has Esther reveal it to the king. Haman's hostility arises from Mordecai's unwillingness to do obeisance to him. On learning that Mordecai is a Jew, Haman determines to destroy the entire Jewish people. Their destruction is to take place on the day determined by casting lots, which turns out to be the 13th or 14th of Adar. The king gives Haman permission to issue such a decree under his name. Greek edition B provides this full text of the decree against the Jews, which is only referred to in the Hebrew version. This text was clearly composed in Greek and was not a part of the Hebrew original. It uses some of the rhetoric and formulas of official decrees and contributes to the realism of the Greek version by highlighting the decree to which Haman went to destroy the Jewish people. The decree is addressed by the king, although we are to imagine that Haman wrote it in the king's name. Addressed to the governors of the 127 provinces in his kingdom. The alleged reason for the decree is to secure the peace of the entire Persian Empire, and the text is presented as an expression of the king's rational and kindly manner. The text praises Haman, which means it is self-praise, praises Haman for his constant goodwill and fidelity, and in particular for his pointing out the threat posed by the Jews to the entire unity and peace of the empire. It describes the Jews as a certain hostile people who perversely follow a strange manner of life and laws. Because of their contrary laws, the Jews are said to present an obstacle to the king's program for a unified and peaceful kingdom. The action proposed by the decree is that all the Jews, men, women, and children, are to be destroyed on the 14th day of the 12th month. The goal is that in a single day, this hostile people will go down in violence to Hades, and that the peace and unity of the empire will be secured. Continuing with the Hebrew version, the consternation of the Jews in chapter 3 begins with the posting of this decree throughout the empire. At Susa, the panic of the Jews contrasts with the carousing of Haman and the king. Mordecai adopts the manner of a penitent petitioner and runs through the city, warning that an innocent nation is being destroyed. When Esther, through her eunuch, tries to comfort Mordecai, he urges her to plead Israel's case before the king. He tells her to call upon the Lord, and then speak to the king on our behalf and save us from death. When Esther objects that no one can approach the king without being summoned by him, Mordecai warns her that as a Jew, she too will be killed, and suggests that she has become the queen for this very crisis. Convinced by Mordecai's reasoning, Esther proposes a 3-day fast among all the Jews of Susa to win God's favor, and determines to approach the king on their behalf. Greek edition C presents the prayers of Mordecai and Esther. Since fasting is generally accompanied by prayer, this edition tells us how and for what these representatives of Israel and Susa were praying. Edition C is biblical in form and content, and it may well have been composed in Hebrew originally. Its effect is to transform an implicitly religious book into an explicitly religious one. The two main characters pray for their people's deliverance to the only Lord, the God of Israel. The apparent irregularities associated with Esther's lifestyle, marriage to a Persian king, eating common food, are confronted and subordinated to her role as the intercessor for God's people. Mordecai addresses the God of Israel as the Lord of all, whom no one can resist. Then he explains why he has refused to do obeisance to Haman. It was not out of personal pride, but out of reverence for the sovereignty of the God of Israel, so that I might not go set out human glory before the glory of God, and I will not bow down to anyone but you, Mordecai says. Finally, Mordecai's petition recalls God's love for the patriarchs and rescue of the people from Egypt, and asks that God spare your people and show mercy upon your inheritance. The prayer of Esther is made in a spirit of distress and mourning. She addresses God as my Lord and as the only real king, and calls upon God to help her while reminding God that God promised to Israel an everlasting inheritance. Esther goes on to attribute Israel's sufferings to its sins, especially the sin of idolatry. But she complains that Israel's enemies have gone too far by trying to abrogate the Torah and to turn Jerusalem, especially the temple, into a place of idolatry. Esther analyzes the present crisis as a contest over kingship between the God of Israel and the enemies of Israel. She pleads that God will make yourself known in the time of our affliction, and save Israel through Esther, who has no helper except the Lord. Esther defends herself against the possible charges that she has married a non-Jew, and that she takes pleasure in wearing the queen's diadem, and that she eats impure food. Instead, she says that her only real joy has been the God of Abraham. Therefore, Esther implores God to save Israel from the hand of evildoers, and to save her from being overwhelmed by fear in approaching the king. Greek edition D describes Esther's entrance before the king, which the Hebrew version recounts in two verses in chapter 5. The effect of edition D is to highlight the figure of Esther and the emotional struggle that she endured to save her people. It also explains why the king was willing to receive her and grant her requests. God changed the spirit of the king to gentleness, we read. At the end of Esther's 3 days of fasting and prayer, she arrays herself in splendid attire and sets out for the royal court. Although she invokes the aid of the all-seeing God and Savior, her heart is nevertheless frozen with fear. On entering the royal throne room, Esther is overwhelmed and terrified, both by the king's splendid appearance and by his angry glance, and so she faints away. But then God changed the spirit of the king to gentleness, and the king explains that the prohibition against approaching the king without being summoned applies only to our subjects, not to Queen Esther. Though reassured by the king, as soon as Esther begins describing the king's glorious appearance, she faints again, thus worrying the king and his servants. Continuing in the Hebrew version, in chapter 5, when the king promises to grant Esther's request, even to half of my kingdom, she asks that the king and Haman come to a banquet. Haman's delight at being singled out to dine with the king and queen is spoiled for him by the sight of Mordecai, the Jew. And so on the advice of his wife and friends, he constructs a gallows for Mordecai to be hanged. Because the Lord took sleep from the king, he happened to read how Mordecai had saved him from the conspiracy of the eunuchs. And so, determined to honor Mordecai publicly, he asks Haman's advice on how to do so without telling him who is going to be honored. Haman provides the advice since he imagines that he himself will receive the honors. When he is told to do as you have said for Mordecai the Jew, he is deeply frustrated. His friends and wife add to his displeasure regarding Mordecai the Jew by reminding him that the living God is with him. On the second day of the banquet, the king once more asks Esther what she wants. She asks for her own life and the life of her people, pointing out this evil man Haman as the enemy of God's people. When the king sees Haman pleading with Esther, he imagines that he is attacking her, and orders that Haman be hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. In the great reversal, the king grants Haman's property to Esther, who turns it over to Mordecai. Then Esther requests that the decree sent by Haman to destroy all the Jews in the empire be rescinded. The king gives Esther permission to have another decree published that will rescind Haman's decree. He also allows the Jews to keep their own laws and to defend themselves, and even to attack their enemies on the very day which they were going to be destroyed. In the Greek edition E, we find this second decree. It provides the full text, which is not found in the Hebrew version, and rescinds the first decree of Haman in edition B. It is written in that same official Greek style as edition B, and likewise is intended to fill in what was perceived as lacking in the Hebrew text. Again, the decree is officially addressed by the king to the governors of the 127 provinces of the empire. He begins in general terms by complaining about people, like Haman, who scheme against their benefactors, like Artaxerxes, and imagines that they will escape the evil-hating justice of God. Next, he assigns blame to Haman, and even claims that he was really a Macedonian who was plotting against the Persian Empire. He praises Mordecai as our savior and perpetual benefactor. Then the king describes the Jews as children of the living God and praises their laws as most righteous, while calling Haman thrice accursed. He rescinds the first decree and interprets Haman's death as a just punishment inflicted by God. Therefore the king allows the Jews to live under their own laws and to defend themselves against attacks. He also decrees that the 13th day of Adar, which has been designated as a day of destruction for the Jews, should be turned into a day of joy. And he threatens that any city or country that fails to respect the second decree will be destroyed. Continuing with the Hebrew text in chapter 8, with the promulgation of the second decree and the great reversal, it becomes a reality. Mordecai appears in public in the glorious attire that Haman had unwittingly prescribed for him, and impresses both Jews and Gentiles. On the 13th day of Adar, the pagan rulers honor Mordecai, and the Jews get revenge and plunder from their enemies. Esther joins in the vengeance by asking the king that the bodies of Haman's 10 sons be hung also for all to see. Both in Susa and elsewhere in the empire, this day and the following days are celebrated with joy and gladness. The record of these events provided by Mordecai and Esther serve as the foundational documents for celebrating the Feast of Purim, which means lots, every year. The main narrative ends in chapter 10 with the description of the king's glorious achievements and of Mordecai's great reputation among both Jews and Gentiles. Greek edition F contains the interpretation of Mordecai's dream at the beginning of the Greek book. In light of what has happened, Mordecai concludes that these things have come from God. Then he equates the figures in the dream with the characters in the narrative. The spring that became a river is Esther. The two dragons are Haman and Esther. And the nations are those Gentiles who sought to destroy Israel, whereas the righteous nation is Israel. Mordecai attributes Israel's rescue to God, and in particular to God's providence in making two lots, one for Israel and the other for the nations, and in guiding events so as to rescue Israel from all these evils. Therefore, the 14th and 15th day of Adar is to be observed forever in Israel as the Feast of Purim, or Lots. The colophon, or the addition at the end of the book, explains when and how the Greek translation of the Book of Esther was made and came to Egypt. Since there were several Egyptian rulers named Ptolemy and Cleopatra, their fourth year could have been 114 BC, which is most likely, or other alternatives were 77 BC or 48 BC. The writer of the colophon seems to express some doubts about Dositheus, who said that he was a priest and Levite, and one can't be both, and about the text itself, which they said was authentic. Thus the colophon is a witness to ancient suspicions surrounding the Book of Esther. The book continued through several revisions, starting with the one we know in Hebrew, and continuing to what we have in the Greek version today. It offers a bit more insight into the book, going behind the scenes, answering some of the questions that people always had about what the decrees said, what they prayed about, and more importantly, introducing an explicit reference to God. For the Greek version essentially makes the Hebrew version an explicitly religious book.